Yes. The two main ones are the following. First of all, we will want to use it as a formalism that is suitable for the study of local versus global entities to do with integration and symmetry. See, for suitably isolated local systems, there should exist a notion of global energy. Think of a galaxy, for example. It should be possible to say, this galaxy has so much rotational energy, or so much angular momentum, so much momentum, so that we can then calculate, for example, collisions of galaxies and things like that. There should be some notion of that. Remember that in Newtonian gravity, we have, of course, notions of energy and momentum and so on, especially gravitational energy, according to Newton, is simply just another form of energy, and it enters into the energy balance just like any other form of energy. This is not so in general relativity, because gravity in general relativity is because of the curvature of space-time. And it's not because of the potential. Ordinarily, things go on curved paths, on bended paths, because there's some force acting on them, which is to say that there's a potential whose derivative is a force. Now, not so in general relativity. The reason why things don't go on straight lines is not because there's a force acting on them, but because space-time itself is curved. But still, there should be some limit in which we recover the Newton formulation. And we should be able to do better than Newton, but still have approximate notions of energy, momentum, angular momentum, and so on. So for that purpose, the tetrad formulation of general relativity will be useful. See, I'm talking about energy, notions of energy and momentum and angular momentum, even in the absence of killing vector fields, in real-life situations. Now, differential forms are integrable. And so we will focus again on differential forms and tensor-value differential forms. So we will try generally to view tensors as much as possible as differential forms that are tensor-value, because that maximizes our ability to integrate. Secondly, another reason for using the tetrad formulation will be for the study of fermions on curved space-time and the Dirac equation. And here the idea is the following. In special relativity, the Dirac equation, which governs the dynamics of electrons, quarks, and so on, has this form. Is everybody familiar with the Dirac equation?
I have not studied it.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, we will go through it. So in special relativity, this is the Dirac equation. And what do we have here? We have a four component vector, with, by the way, four complex entries. Four component complex entries vector, depending on space and time, of course, so vector field, called a spin-up field. And the analog of the Kleinghoven equation for electrons and quarks is this Dirac equation. Here you have the ordinary partial derivative, which on special relativity is done. And then here you have those so-called gamma matrices. Those gamma matrices have to obey the following equation. If you write down the anticommutator of those gamma matrices, gamma mu plus gamma mu gamma mu, then that anticommutator has to be 2 times the metric, and therefore it has to be 2 times this matrix. So the gamma matrices have to be 4x4 matrices obeying this anti-commutation relation. Now, for special relativity, that's all fine. What you do in practice is you do a little linear algebra, and you find such matrices gamma, 4 matrices gamma, which obey these commutation relations. You plug them into here, and you get the actual Dirac equation. In fact, it's 4 equations, because it's for every one of those 4 components of psi, it's an equation. So So this is what you do in special relativity. But the thing about it, there's a problem for general relativity. Because if we do in general relativity, in the way that it is usually done in a first course of general relativity, we would have that this metric, the metric cancel, Jimmy knew, would not always look like that. In general, it would be some a pretty messy function of space and time with all sorts of complicated entries in here. Which would mean that at every point in space and time, we'd have to solve this equation afresh. Find root gamma matrices, and so on. And then they become space and time dependent. How on earth is that going to go down with this? Okay, so that's complicated. That is another thing that we will be able to address with the so-called tetrad formula.
So when you had said a statement that in general relativity particles are moving straight line because the geometry is curved.
Yes.
But why do we need tetrad formulation for that? That is not given.
The point was this, that according to pre-general relativity theory, when particles deviated from the straight line path, it was because a force was acting on them. In other words, there was a potential, it was derivative, it's a force, and that force was the reason for why the particle deviated from a straight line. In general relativity, this is no longer the case. The particles can travel on complicated curves without a force acting on them. They simply follow the curvature. They simply go on geodesics. Okay? Which is to say that there is, in general, no gravitational potential whose derivative would be a force. There just isn't. But you would like to have something like a gravitational potential because it's an easy way to think of what's going on. For example, when you have a galaxy or several galaxies that might orbit another or somehow gravitationally interact, it's the easiest way to think of it to say, it has so much energy and it has so much momentum, so much angular momentum, instead of going into the details of the curvature. You would have overall balance of energy. We would like to extract from general relativity what the generalization of the gravitational potential would be.
And tetrad formulation will be useful for that?
Will be useful for that because part of the tetrad formulation is that we will separate in the tensor its form part from its tensor part. So we will look at tensor value differential forms. And we will also free ourselves from the usual choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent and tensor spaces, and we will choose them orthonormally. And this is also the reason why it would be very convenient for the Dirac equation on curved space. Maybe remember that we are free to choose the bases in every tangent space independently of the coordinate system. We can choose whatever bases we like. And that means in particular that we are free to choose a basis at every point of the manifold, such that the metric at every point of the manifold takes this Minkowski form. We don't have to prove this anymore. We know that this is the case. We can choose a basis like that. Do you have a quick argument why we know that this is so? Remember that if we choose a Gaussian coordinate system, I mean, a Riemann normal coordinate system, a geodesic coordinate system, about at some point P of the manifold. Right? We know that if we do that, then at that point, the metric will have this form if we choose the simple coordinate fixes. D by dx1, d by dx2, d by x3, etc. In this basis, at the point P of the manifold, the metric will have this form. Only at this point, but at this point. But what this tells us is that at this point, this is the right basis to get the matrix in this form. But we can choose any point we like on the manifold. At every point, we can choose Riemann normal coordinate system, a geodesic coordinate system, and determine, therefore, what the right basis is to make the metric look like this. We can do it at every point. So we simply choose that basis at every point. And for the coordinate system, we choose whatever we like. Doesn't have to be Riemann normal coordinate system. We can just use it as a tool to find out which is the right basis at a particular point. But what the business with the geodesic coordinate system shows us is that at every point, there is a basis of the tangent space in which the metric will take this form. And third, once we use the formalism of tetras, we will get another important benefit. We will see that general relativity can be viewed as a so-called gauge theory, as a theory that is analogous to the gauge theories of electromagnetism and the Stoneman-Weak interaction. And this has been the starting point for a number of studies into quantum gravity. So let us remember the math. What is a frame, and what's an orthonormal frame? A frame is some basis, it's a choice of bases at every point of the manifold, a choice of bases of the cotangent space and the tangent space at every point of the manifold. That's a frame. And we choose the basis for the tangent space always to be the dual basis to that of the cotangent space. But other than that, you're completely free to choose whatever basis you like at every point of the manifold. In first courses of general relativity, this choice is not highlighted to be a choice generally, and you're usually presented with a canonical choice. Namely, if you're given a coordinate system, you choose these as a basis for the cotangent spaces and those as a basis of the tangent spaces, but as we discussed at length already, that's not necessary. So if we choose, you see the big disadvantage of choosing those coordinates, so those bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces is that if we change coordinates, then we are led to change bases. And so the two are artificially linked. But we don't have to link them at all. We can always choose whatever basis we like in the cotangent space, independently of whatever coordinate system we may want to choose. So just to stress this for the last time, the only reason why the components of a tensor can change when we change coordinates is that we can change bases in the cotangent space and tangent space along with the change of coordinates. If you go from one canonical choice of bases that comes with the choice of coordinates to another, then yes, the coefficients of the vector will change. But only if we decide, if we choose to change bases in the tangent spaces along with the change of coordinates. Remember that the vector itself, the tangent vector itself, is always the same one, no matter what coordinate system, no matter what basis you choose. So if psi, for example, is a tangent vector, and you've chosen a coordinate system x, the d by dx form basis vectors of the tangent spaces, you may want to choose those, then your tangent vector psi has an expansion in terms of those basis vectors. These are, of course, functions of space and time. And then if you choose another coordinate system, then you get, at the same point in speed, you get different basis vectors of the tangent space. And since they are different from those, they are linear combinations of those, these coefficients in front of it also will change, right? But that's only because you change bases in the tangent space. There is no other reason why those coefficients change. The vector itself, after all, stays completely the same. So if we choose a fixed basis, say a basis of theta mu for the cotangent space and a basis of e mu for the tangent space, but then the coefficients of tangent vectors, the cotangent vectors, the tensors in general, no longer depend on the choice of coordinate system. They are scalars. For example, if this is a basis in the tangent space, this is our tangent vector here, the same as that one above, and it will have some coefficients or coefficient functions in front of those basis vectors. And as you change coordinate system, nothing changes here. As long as we stick to the same basis in the tangent spaces, nothing changes. Those coefficients are the same. These are scalar functions. They don't change with the coordinate system. Conversely, even when we don't change the coordinate system, we can still change the basis. Okay, so we stick with one coordinate system. It has nothing to do with it, really. And we simply change bases. We may change our mind. We don't want to choose the bases that we used before. We want to change the new, but we want to change the new base. So this might be the old basis in the cotangent space. and that is a new basis in the contention space. Of course, all of those equations depend on space and time. So this is a theta nu of x and t, and this is a change of basis matrix that depends in general on space and time. And for every contention space, we can change its basis in this way. This is a matrix of change of basis coefficients. Then, since we want the basis vectors in the tangent space to be always dual to the cotangent spaces basis, we obtain that in order for these to be dual to those, this has to be the inverse matrix to that. We already covered. So in this case, we have then the vector, which of course is the same thing no matter what basis you choose in the tangent space or cotangent space. So our tangent vector is some coefficients, some linear combination of the original basis vectors with some coefficients, which can be expressed as, I'm just expressing those basis vectors in terms of the new basis vectors, simply solving that equation here for the E. And then you see the E are the A matrix acting on the E. So we obtain that. And now we can read off that these coefficients are the coefficients of our tangent vector psi and the new basis. So we obtain that the psi prime are obtained from the psi coefficients using their matrix. Right? And nothing to do with the change of coordinate system. It's just a change of basis in the tangent space. So, for example, we took the curvature tensor, identified two of its covariant components as forming a differential two form, and then we were left with one contravariant and one covariant index. So the curvature, so we obtain the curvature two form, which is a 1-1 tensor value two form. Here it is. And if we change basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces in this way, then these are the transformation rules that the curvature two form will undergo. And remember, that has nothing to do with the general coordinate system. Just the change of tangent space, the tangent basis vectors. On the other hand, we also considered what happens to the connection one form. Remember, the connection one form is obtained from the Christoffel symbols. It has one upper index, two lower indices. One lower index was considered to be a differential one form. And then we were left with an upper and a lower index, but we realized that they are not tensorial. So the affine connection gives us a connection one form, but it's not tensor value. And we will soon find out what it is valued, what it is taking values in. It's not going to be tensors. Remember that from the transformation rules for the Christoffel symbols, we obtained that in a new basis, the connection one form will transform not tensorially. Tensorially would mean that the upper index would transform with the A matrix, just like our contravariant vector, and the lower index would transform with the inverse matrix. No, it's not tensorial because we get this additional term here, which just depends on how we write hello. And that's just the matrix notation for that. All right. So good. Now, how do we specify frames or tetrads for that matter? Tetrads are simply going to be orthogonal. So, in an arbitrary coordinate system, we may specify the basis, our choice of basis in the tangent spaces, simply this way. We can say, well, given the coordinate system, we're given a canonical basis right away of the cotangent space, for example. Those guys form the basis of the cotangent space. We don't want to be restricted to this. We may want to choose another basis. And this other basis, no matter what it is, it's going to be a linear combination of the canonical basis that comes with the coordinate system. So by specifying such a change of basis matrix, we can specify our real choice of basis that we want to use. We can specify our choice of basis in the conventional space relative to the canonical basis that comes with the coordinate system. That is often a very useful thing to do, but it's not the only way you could do it. Another way to do it would be, for example, this. Take an arbitrary function, an arbitrary zero form, just a function, on the manifold, and look at this differential. That's going to be a one form. It's going to be a vector, a cotangent vector at every point on the manifold. Now, if you take four arbitrary generic functions, and you take their four differentials, then you will get at every point. So almost everywhere in the manifold, those four potential vectors will form a basis. They will not be orthonormal in general, but they will form a basis. So that would be another way to specify bases at almost all points of the manifold. Simply specify four functions. And then say that the differentials give me four potential vectors at every point of the manifold. In practice, though, one usually does it this way. But you see, the other way that I just specified had the advantage that it's not referring to a coordinate system. You're just saying four functions. You specify four functions, that's it. And that gives you, at every point of the manifold, four potential vectors, simply by taking the differentials of those functions. Whereas here, we are defining our choice of basis relative to a change, to a canonical coordinate system, canonical basis in terms of the coordinates. And then obviously, if we change coordinate system, and we still want to stick to the same basis here, then those coefficients will change. Okay.
So the ones that come with the coordinate system are basically like the ones that come by applying the differential operator to each of the coordinates.
To each of the coordinate functions, that's right. Okay, so from now on, we will choose orthonormal frames. Which is to say that we are choosing theta mu's that are not just linearly independent. No, we want them to be orthonormal as well. And by that we mean generalized orthonormal, because it's going to be orthonormality with respect to the metric, but the metric is a positive definite. So we cannot expect that they all have length 1. Some of them may have length minus 1. So a tetrad is going to be a frame that's orthonormal, meaning that a tetrad is a choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, such that the metric using this basis takes this form everywhere. So every point of the manifold, this is the metric. You can also view it this way. You can say that at every point of the manifold, we choose that basis, which is the canonical basis that comes with a Riemann normal coordinate system for that point. That was my next point here. Does this problem exist? Well, yes, it does exist, because we know that we can choose those theta mu at every point to be the dx mu of a Riemann normal coordinate system about that point. Now,
so you say that we cannot choose a local inertial frame at all points on the same time. We can only do it at one point of the time.
That's right.
So this problem would arise even.
Remember that. We choose the geodesic coordinate system at an arbitrary point. This gives us dxi. We choose those dxi to be the bases at that point. And now we choose another point of the manifold. We get another set of dxi, okay, from the Riemann normal coordinate system about that other point. And that gives us the theta for that point. And we do that at every point. And therefore, at every point of the manifold, we end up with a choice of basis vectors such that the metric looks like this. So it will look like that every point of the manifold. Now, is that unique? Any guesses? Can it be unique without reading? There going to be a unique tetra? Yeah, that's right. There's not going to be a unique tetra. And the reason is that there's going to be quite a few bases that have the property that the metric takes this special relativistic form. You see, for given space-time Mg, any orthonormal frame yields a new orthonormal frame, but if we transform the bases, let's say this basis, with some matrix into a new basis, as long as this matrix preserves the orthonormality. So we want that the matrix eta AB, which describes the special relativistic formulation of the metric, this eta AB, which is the metric in a tetra choice of bases, should not change when we change bases. Which is to say that this matrix, minus 1 plus 1, plus 1 plus 1, goes into itself under a linear transformation. But do you remember, I hope you remember from special relativity, the name of those matrices, of those transformations that keep the Minkowski metric the same. This is the transformed Minkowski metric, and that's the original Minkowski metric. It stays the same. The set of all linear transformations that leave the matrix, minus 1, 1, 1, 1, invariant. Name of the
Lorentz
transformation. These are the Lorentz transformations, right. So in other words, a tetrad is unique only up to Lorentz transformations. In fact, local Lorentz transformations. Not global Lorentz transformations, that's a special relativity, but local Lorentz transformations. At every point of the space-time, if we change the basis using a Lorentz transformation to a new basis, then the metric stays the same. That's the definition of a Lorentz transformation. The metric stays the same. Therefore, the new basis also qualifies for tetra. And therefore, the choice of tetra is not unique.
And the reason why the choice of tetra is not unique is because we cannot choose a global inertial frame of reference.
No. Nothing to do with it. We're doing much better here. We're saying that it's not unique because we can choose locally an arbitrary Lorentz transformation and still keep an orthonormal basis. So we can now answer an old question that we raised a while ago, and that I alluded to at the beginning of the class today. Remember that the connection one forms, omega mu nu, are really just the Christoffel symbols, where you take one of the low indices, consider it to be a differential one form, and then you're left with an upper and lower index. So this is the connection one form. But we also know, we noticed that it's not a 1-1 tensor-relative one form. These are not tensor components, and transformation properties, for example, don't match. So the question then is, if this is a one form that takes its values not in a 1-1 tensor, and I'm saying takes its values in the following sense. If you have a tensor relative form, then the form part is eager to eat up contravariant vectors. Now imagine you feed your form part with contravariant vectors until it is satisfied, then you're left with a tensor, right? That's why it is called a such and such tensor value differential form. If you let the differential form eat up contravariant vectors, you end up with a tensor as the output, right? Now this thing is not going to give you a 1-1 tensor once you contract its form part with a contravariant vector. So what is it going to give you? Now it turns out that what the connection one form does is it gives you a value in the set of infinitesimal Lorentz transform. So those two indices are really the indices of a Lorentz transformation, of an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, that is. And there is a simple intuition to that. You see, the connection, the affine connection, was introduced to tell us the change of direction of a vector as you parallel transport it. You parallel transport it in a direction, and then along some path, and then the vector will change direction. It is a one form, meaning it is asking for a contravariant vector to eat it up, right? And that contravariant vector is the direction in which you want to parallel transport. Okay? So once you choose the direction in which you want to parallel transport, you have that direction vector, it's a contravariant vector, you feed it into this one form, and then you get out this matrix with two indices. And the claim is, and it's very intuitive, that what those two indices stand for is a matrix that describes a Lorentz transformation. More precisely, an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Because we are not moving with the affine connection arbitrarily far, not a finite distance. We're just saying if you move infinitesimally in some direction, then the vector will be changing its direction, the vector that you're parallel transporting, will be changing its direction infinitesimally. So what you get is an infinitesimal rotation of that vector. And of course, on a Riemannian manifold, it's simply just a rotation. On a pseudo-Riemannian manifold or Lorentz manifold, it's a Lorentz transformation. Lorentz transformations are simply rotations in a space that need not have the plus 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 signature, but could have, for example, a minus one. So let's see how that works out. What are infinitesimal Lorentz transformations? And once we know that, we'll check whether the affine connections one form is giving us one of them. So first, what are infinitesimal Lorentz transformations? And why is that what we get out of the connection one form? Okay, so an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation can certainly be written in this form. So this is going to be a Lorentz transformation, one of those matrices, which if you use it to change bases, will leave the metric invariant. We can always write it as the identity plus something small. If you're looking at infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, we encode it in this way that we say the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation is the identity plus a matrix with small coefficients, in fact so small that any square of those coefficients, any product of any two such coefficients, we can set equal to zero. So then, what does the fact that A has to be a Lorentz transformation mean for those coefficients epsilon? Well, remember from an equation we had the tabula, A is a Lorentz transformation if it leaves the Minkowski metric invariant. If we spell it out, it means that A is replaced by that, and this A as well is replaced by that. We just have this product here. So the requirement that A is a Lorentz transformation translates into this equation. Now we have the product of two conical deltas with the eta. That just gives us the eta again. So the term that we get from multiplying this term with that term is canceling with this term here. And we also get the term with epsilon times epsilon that is zero because we are considering infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. And then we get two mixed terms, this one and that one. And I wrote it down here. Therefore, for A to be an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, these coefficients here have to obey this equation. Now, this is just a metric. And in fact, since we have chosen a tetrad, this is really our metric, not just for Minkowski space, but even for curved space time. This is really the metric. So we can use it to lower the indices. And we obtain that If A is an infinite is a non-transformation, then the epsilon obeys that equation. In fact, it also works the other way around. If you take any matrix that is anti-symmetric, so obeys this equation here, plug it in there, then you obtain an infinitesimal non-transformation. So the question is, are we getting an infinitesimal non-transformation from the affine connection? So the claim is that we do, and that means in practice that in orthonormal frames in tetras, the connection one form, omega mu nu, I know what one of the indices, obeys this equation. If we can show that, then we are in business, because that is the equation for infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. This is the infinitesimal rotation, right? The epsilon is a matrix of infinitesimal rotation. So the overall Lorentz transformation is the identity plus a little bit of rotation, where rotation is in this, rotation in the generalized sense, where it could also be including a boost, because it's rotating space versus time. Okay, so what we have to show is that this equation really holds for the connection one form. We have to prove that. Let's remember a few things. First of all, there's the absolute exterior derivative. The absolute exterior derivative takes this form. If you apply it to a tensor-valued form, then you get the exterior derivative of that form plus the covariant derivative part. You see, it's absolute exterior derivative. It has the covariant derivative built into it and the exterior derivative built into it. So here you have the regular exterior derivative acting on it, considering it as a form. And then we also have those covariant derivatives. You see, why there are covariant derivatives, just recall that those connection one forms here are really just Christoffel symbols. Okay? So the main thing you have to keep in mind to remember from this business of the absolute exterior derivative is that if you apply the absolute exterior derivative on a pure form, then it's just the exterior derivative. If you apply it to a pure tensor, that's not a differential form. Well, as far as the form is concerned, it's a zero form. So if you apply it to a pure tensor, then it's just a covariant derivative. And if it's a tensor-valued differential form, then it's a mixture of the two, and this is how it looks like. It's the exterior derivative plus coefficients that you get for the covariant derivative part. Now, let us apply this to the metric itself. This equation holds because it is the consistency condition between the affine connection and the metric. Remember that if the metric is to describe the same space time as the affine connection, then this equation has to hold. Now, the metric is not a form. It is purely a tensor. It's a 0-2 tensor, and as far as differential forms are concerned, it's a 0 form. Therefore, the covariant derivative of it is the same as the absolute exterior derivative of it. And the absolute exterior derivative is the part which is the exterior derivative, which is the zero here because the metric is actually constant. No, it's just the Minkowski metric as a matrix. And then you get those terms as well, which, you know, think of the omegas as coding for the Christoffel symbols. You get lots of those terms here. Now, here we have the metric. We can use it to lower those indices. And the best product is just a regular product because the metric is not a differential form at all. I mean, it's a zero form, so it's just multiplying. And therefore, all that happens here is that we lower those indices. And the whole thing is equal to zero. So we end up with this equation, and that is what we have to show. So what we showed is that the connection one form is Lorentz transformation value. If you feed it as a form, if you feed it a direction vector, then it tells you which infinitesimal Lorentz transformation your vector will undergo under parallel transport in the direction. So now we can go to the tensor formulation of temporal boosting. Remember that we described the shape of our pseudo-Riemannian manifold by giving two data, the differential manifold and the metric on it. Alternatively, we were also able to describe the same manifold by giving the manifold the same space-time, by giving the manifold and the Christoffel symbol, which is to say we gave the affine connection. That was the same thing. And now we have yet another way of describing the same manifold. We can describe the same manifold by giving the differentiable manifold and by giving a tetrad, by telling which basis vectors at each point are diagonalizing the metric. This is non-trivial information to say which basis vectors at every point are diagonalizing the metric. And I have to show to you why that is so. Why is it that if you give the manifold and information about which basis diagonalizes the metric, so that you get the Minkowski metric, which basis, if you have that information, you can recover, for example, the metric description. So, for example, assume that the theta I are given with respect to a basis dx mu, which is to say that our choice of basis, which is not arbitrary, it's got to be orthonormal. It's got to be a choice of basis in which the metric takes the Minkowski form. So assume that the theta I are such a basis and that it is a linear combination given by a matrix A of the canonical basis that comes with the coordinate. So the theta I are such a basis that the metric takes this form. Now it turns out that all the information about the shape of the manifold is now encoded in those functions. See, it cannot be encoded in the metric anymore, because the metric just looks everywhere like this. Okay? So previously, when we were choosing always the basis that came with the coordinate system, then the metric was generally a complicated matrix-valued function, and that matrix-valued function carried all the information about the shape of the manifold. Now it can no longer, because the metric is completely trivialized. At every point of the manifold, it looks like this. And now all the information about the shape of the manifold sits in those functions that specify the basis. And in order to prove that really all of the information is in there, let us carry out what's necessary. Namely, assume that all you're given is that matrix. Can you reconstruct the metric in the coordinate basis? The answer is yes, and it's not even hard. Remember that the metric tensor is the same tensor no matter what coordinate system, no matter what basis in tension spaces you choose. So the metric tensor can be written either using the frame basis as the Minkowski matrix for the metric with the frame basis here, or you can also write those frame basis vectors using those coefficient functions. You can express those in terms of the canonical coordinate basis. So I'm taking this equation here and I'm replacing the theta by A times dx. Okay? So what you're saying is that the metric can be written either using the tetrad formulation in this way, or if we use the equation that expresses those theta in terms of the dx, then we obtain this representation for our g, And what do we have? We have some matrix here with two coefficients, with two indices, g mu nu of x times dx mu tensor dx mu. So we can read off from the comparison of this with that what g mu nu of x is enough. G mu nu of x has to be this thing, right? Just eta times the a and b. Okay, so what we have shown so far is that the all information about the shape of the manifold can be encoded simply in the specification of that basis here, in the specification, for example, of those coefficient functions. But that means that it should be possible to formulate everything about general relativity and its dynamics in terms of those thetas, rather than in terms of g. And indeed, it will turn out that the variational principle can be carried out for the theta rather than for the g. So we can vary the action with respect to the theta rather than with respect to the g. Remember that varying the action with respect to g was to vary the action with respect to the shape of the manifold. But now we know that the choice of the theta, concretely, if you write it out in coordinates, the choice of the a, also determines the shape of the manifold. Therefore, the variation of the action with respect to the shape of the manifold can be expressed as varying with respect to g, or as varying with respect to theta. But varying with respect to theta will have a special physical significance, if you are familiar with gauge theory, because it means that we allow local Lorentz transformations. As opposed to global transformations. You see, in special relativity, a guiding principle is that all of the physics has to be invariant under global Lorentz transformations, which is to say that every inertial observer sees the same physics. And now we will be able to do the variation of the action with respect to the theta, which are local Lorentz transformations, right? I mean, the theta are not unique, we can vary them, and that variation expresses local Lorentz transformations. And the physics will be the same, so we can ask that ds by d theta, the variation of the action with respect to theta is vanishing, and that will give us the gravitational gravity, that will give us the Einstein effect. So you can view it in this way, that in special relativity, laws of nature stay the same if we perform a global Lorentz transformation. If we perform a local Lorentz transformation, where we transform here differently than over there, then we're not simply changing from one inertial observer to another inertial observer. We are not going from one inertial coordinate system to another inertial coordinate system. And in special relativity, these things fade up. We don't get the same shape of the laws of nature. In general relativity, we do, but we have to pay a price, if you want to call it a price. And the price that we have to pay is that a new force comes in. That's correct. And it's a very similar thing in electromagnetism and in the strong and weak interactions. And in case you haven't seen that before, I just give you a little hint of what the gauge principle is. Consider the Schrödinger equation of a free electron. What's the gauge principle there? Well, if you take the Schrödinger equation for the free electron, it is an equation for a wave function psi of x, complex valued scalar function psi of x. Now, if you take that wave function, let's just say it's a solution to the Schrödinger equation, and you multiply that solution of the Schrödinger equation with e to the power I alpha, then you're not changing anything. It is still a solution to the Schrödinger equation. After all, you just multiply with a constant, and the Schrödinger equation is linear in psi, so it's still a solution to the Schrödinger equation. And moreover, you're not even changing any probabilities for your predictions because it's just a phase. And therefore, it's not changing the probability amplitude. You're only changing the probability amplitude by a phase, but probabilities are always modulus squares of wave functions, and therefore, you're not even changing that. So far, so good for the Schrödinger equation for of a free electron. But now, imagine you want to allow yourself to have this alpha being a function of space as well, and perhaps even of time, but it seems just a function of space as well. Now things change. You're still not changing the probabilities that come from the probability amplitude, but if psi of x was a solution of the Schrödinger equation, then e to the power I alpha of x times psi of x is most likely no longer a solution of the Schrödinger equation. And that's because the Schrödinger equation includes space derivatives. And they will pick up on that. And that will screw things up. It's no longer a solution. However, you can modify the Schrödinger equation, introduce extra terms, such that this transformation, where you allow alpha to be a function of space, still gets you from a solution to a solution. And you have to pay a price for that. And the price is that you have to introduce a new force, in this case, the electromagnetic force. So that's the gauge principle. You go from allowing only global transformations of your field to local transformations, and still the shape of your laws of nature don't change, but the price that you have to pay, then you have to introduce a new force, and in this case, it's electromagnetism. For the weak interaction, for the strong interaction, this is not just a number, but instead those guys are vector values, this is a matrix, and the whole thing becomes a little more complicated because this is a space and time dependent matrix values are gauging. And then you can carry that elsewhere as well. And so what I wanted to say is that in special relativity, you can perform a global Lorentz transformation on everything, and you don't change anything. If you do a local Lorentz transformation, then you screw things up. It's no longer the same laws. But you can enforce to still get the same laws. But you have to introduce gravity in this way. So let's just see how that happens in practice. So what we want to do is we want to express the action principle in terms of a new set of variables now. We used to express the action principle in terms of variations with respect to the metric and the dynamic quantity that we were putting into the action was the Ricci scalar. Now, and for the action equation was expressed in terms of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. Now we want to express everything in terms of the curvature 2 form and the tetrad. So we start with what we know, and that is that the gravity action takes this form, here's the Ricci scalar, here's the Boltzmann form. This is the zero form. Let us divide that in terms of the new framework. Remember the hot star operation? If mu is a B form, can always be written in this form, then the Hodge star applied to the B form gives us that expression, and in particular it maps a T form into an A minus B form. And what we can read off from that in the case where we are dealing with a zero form or an N form is that in fact the antigravity action is simply the Hodge star on the Ricci scalar. The Hodge star will take us from this zero form into a four form, and it will produce this variable g as a measure as well. Okay, so the R itself is just a zero form, but with the star it becomes a four form that includes the whole thing, including the measure. So we really don't have to think as this consisting of two different things, as a zero form times an N form. A four form, the volume form. But instead, we can simply say that the whole thing is simply a zero form whose Hodge star is named. So now our aim is to re-express the Einstein action in terms of least dynamical degrees of freedom and the curvature two form. For that purpose, it will be convenient to introduce variables that allow us to make our formulas a little bit more complex. This is not meant to be an H, it's meant to be a capital eater. So I don't know how one is supposed to know that by just looking at it, but you know, in Greek, the little eater is what we usually go as an eater, and the capital eater is the H. So the capital eater, AB, is by definition the modestar of the net product of two of our basis vectors. So those guys form an orthonormal frame, tetra. We take two of those guys, and so two specific ones, alpha and beta, and we take the modestar of that, and what do we get? We get the two form out of this, but we are having still two indices, so it's a 0,2 tensor value two form. I hope you're not confused by this having upper indices and still it's a lower. It's a 0,2 tensor value two form.
So I think there's a circle around the edge that denotes that it's kept
in
theta.
Circle around the edge?
Yes, it's edge inside a circle.
I can't see that. You're thinking of theta, perhaps.
Yeah.
Now that would be the coverage of theta then. Okay, and you can also take three of those guys, three of those basis vectors, theta alpha, theta gamma, and so if you take the wedge product, you get a 3-form, if you take the hot dual of that, you get a 1-form, so the whole thing is a 0,3 tensor value, 0,3 tensor value, 1. Again, to see that, why do we have to have the indices lower here, well, if you just spell it out, this is what it is to take the Hodge star of that 2-form, and you see that those two indices are taken up to make the form, and then we're left with those two lower indices here, they're covariant indices. That's why this whole thing is a 0,2 tensor value 2-form. Okay, and this guy is a 0,3 tensor value 1-form, because there are three lower indices left over after we declare this to be form. Okay. Now the proposition is that hot star of R, which if you remember is the thing that we integrate with the Einstein action, remember? The Einstein action is a two constant, the hot star of R. The claim is that the hot star of R is, in terms of our new variable, simply this, which we will have to show. So it's the curvature 2-form, which is a 2,0 tensor values 2-form. Here we have a 0,2 tensor values 2-form, and therefore the whole thing is a 4-form, which is 0,0 tensor. 0,0 tensor values 4-form. So let's prove that. Remember that the curvature 2-form was obtained by taking the Riemann curvature tensor and declaring those three indices, which are covariant and have anti-symmetry, to be a differential form part. So it is what we obtain when we take that to be a form, and then we are left with those two indices. So the curvature 2-form is a 1-1 tensor value 2-form. And therefore, when we take the net product of it with the eta and the nu, then we get four of those guys. Just remember that the eta alpha beta has two of those, and the square root of g, and the epsilon tensor. So it's kind of a little bit tedious, but. So what we get here is the Riemann curvature tensor, two basis vectors here, and then from the eta we get the square root of g, we get the epsilon tensor, and we get two more of those guys. Okay, this wedge product can be spelled out, of course, in terms of tensor products if we use the epsilon tensor. Now we use.
How do you raise the second index on R? You didn't add an extra factor g in there, did you?
Sorry? But you can use, you can raise that with a metric.
Yeah, but okay, you just.
Now, we can use something, an equation, a relation between epsilon tensors that I don't ask you to know by heart. You see, that if you take two of those totally anti-symmetric four tensors and you contract them in this way, then you get this in terms of Carnot invariance. So obviously this is much easier to handle on the left-hand side. You don't have to know exactly by heart how those indices match up and anything, how that looks like. But you need to know that it exists, and you need to have some source where you can look it up in case you need it. Because it actually can easily happen if you have a product of two epsilon tensors whenever you deal with two differential forms. So this is a useful equation that you just need to know where to look up. Okay, if we use that, we obtain that h mu, that omega mu, is this expression. You see, this whole business with the two epsilon tensors, one coming from here, writing this out as a tensor product, the other one coming from here, collapses because those Kronecker deltas are easily evaluated, just setting indices equal. So we obtain that, which is as easy as it is to verify simply hot star of R. Another thing that you will need is that the absolute exterior derivative of eta mu is vanishing. This comes about in the following way. The absolute derivative of the eta is the absolute derivative of whatever the eta is. We spell it out here again. It's the hot star of the wedge product of two of our basis vectors of the frame. It's a derivation. So we get two terms here. Well, we get in principle also that indeed is acting on those guys, but the metric in our frame is a constant. So we get that it acts on the first theta plus that it acts on the second theta. But since this is a frame that is equal to zero, that was one of our equations of, was it Monday, I think? It's the first structure equation expressed for the frame. The d theta mu is equal to zero in the torsionless case. I put it all together for you on the next slide again, just as a reminder what those equations were. Remember, we had two structure equations and two Young-Lie identities. And just to remind you of them, one structure, this is the torsionless case, with the torsion would be a little bit more messy. The torsionless case, we have the d theta I is equal to zero. Which is what we just used. The second structure equation expresses the curvature 2 form in terms of the connection 1 form. This thing should look plausible to you because remember what the affine connection 1 form really is. It's just a Christoffel circle where one index is declared to be 1 form. Right? Then what do we have here? We have here the exterior derivative of that. It's just regular derivative of this thing. And what are those guys? They're Christoffel symbols. So that should remind you of the way you may have seen or what you have seen in some previous lectures, and perhaps even in a previous course, how the curvature tensor is expressed in terms of Christoffel symbols. What you get is terms that are derivatives of the Christoffel symbols. That's this here. And you get terms that are squares of Christoffel symbols. So the Riemann curvature tensor can be expressed in terms of Christoffel symbols derivatives plus squares of, I mean, product of Christoffel symbols with Christoffel symbols. That's really what the second structure equation is expressing. And then we have those Bianchi identities, which you remember are very useful to know, but not deep physically. They just express general properties of the framework, such as the Jacobi identity. And that's what they are. So the exterior, the absolute exterior derivative of the curvature 2 form is actually 0, which is good to know. And also its contraction with a 1 frame is difficult. Oh, yes, and then I put also another equation here. Remember something that we showed at the beginning of the lecture today, namely that for orthonormal frames, the connection one form is having this property here, which told us that the connection one form is not tensor-valued form, but a Lorentz transformation valued form, or precisely infinitesimal Lorentz transformation valued form. So now the main proposition is that if we vary the action with respect to the theta mu, so if we vary the action in the integral of the star R, then we obtain an expression like that, where this is the exterior derivative of something. The important point being that we are really varying not star R, but we are varying the integral over star R, which means that the variation is integral over this plus integral over that. But then we have the integral over the co-boundary operator of something. And that means by Stokes' theorem that we get a boundary term. And then hopefully we can argue that the boundary term will not contribute. So then we will just obtain here this expression left over. So we will obtain that the variation of the actual action, which involves integrating over the whole thing, gives us an integral over all of this, integral over that, plus the integral over something over the boundary, going here to there, yes, those four. So keep in mind that in what follows now, this delta stands not for the co-derivative, for the co-differentials, but it stands for the variation. Okay. Oh, and I should say that one of you, Jonathan, found a mistake in my previous one of my previous lectures. The co-differential is not a derivation. It is the dual of the derivation, but not the derivation itself. I have to fix that in my notes. Okay. So this is the variation of the frame field. Okay, and eventually we're going to end up with the Einstein equation in this new frame. For that purpose, we will need to also describe the early momentum tensor in the new framework with the frames. And how do we do that? Well, we define the energy momentum one form simply in this way. We define it as the solution to this equation, the variation of the action with respect to the with respect to the frame. Is the integral over the variation of the frame, that product with something, and whatever that something is, we call the energy momentum one form. Which is, of course, simply, if you rewrite it, it's simply taking the energy momentum tensor, which is a two-fold covariant tensor, and you consider one of the covariant indices to make it a one-fold. So it becomes a one, not a zero, one tensor value. And then the claim is that the equation of motion of general relativity, the Einstein equation, is obtained by setting the variation of the gravitational action plus the matter action with respect to the frame field equal to zero. And that this then becomes this equation here. Remember, we already discussed that this is the variation of the Einstein action with respect to the frame field, and we just had a line above that the variation of the matter action with respect to theta gives us the energy momentum one form. And I'll leave it to you as a little exercise to figure out exactly how the cosmological constant would fit into this. Now the you see, this is a one form here, and with the star it becomes a three form. And of course, on the left hand side we have a three form as well. Remember that the ether with the three indices was one form. This is the curve of the two form with the product of the two is the three. So it all matches up. This is a 0-1 tensor value three form, and that is a 0-1 tensor value three. And we can introduce the following definition. The Einstein form is the Einstein tensor contracted with the frame basis vectors. And then it turns out that the Hodge dual of the Einstein form is this expression here with the bar. You see that this means that the Einstein equation can be written in this form. It's simply not an equation, but the Hodge star vector. So that we get rid of the Hodge star over there, and we get it over here, therefore. And we have star of star, and that's just itself. Okay, so the Einstein equation will take this form when we express it in terms of a tetrad, and when we express all tensors as much as possible as differential forms. So the main proposition now needs to be proved. The main proposition was that the variation of the Einstein action, not really the action just the action would be obtained by integrating over star r. So the variation of star r is this expression here plus the d of something. Right? If we can prove that, then anything I said before follows. So how do we prove this? Alright, let us I'll go through that. The variation of star r is the variation of h eta mu nu omega mu nu, because this is what star r was. So it's the variation of eta, leaving omega the same, plus leaving eta the same and varying omega. Let us look at the first term first. The variation of eta mu nu is the variation of this expression, just by definition. This is how we define eta mu nu. This, using a frame, this is a constant. The metric is a constant there. And we can write this as Right. So all we have to do is to vary this term and vary that term. But if we do that, we obtain simply the variation of the theta, veg 1 theta. But the 1 theta is the theta mu nu rho. You remember that? Theta mu nu rho was the Hodge star of 1 theta. And that's what we get here. You see, if you take one theta and multiply it with that distance, that is the Hodge star of that one theta. And that is what we call the eta, eta mu rho. Okay, so what we have then is that just having calculated that into piece, we have that the variation of star r is, using that here, the first term is this piece, which omega nu rho plus, and now we need that invariant, we have to calculate what this is. So what is the variation of the curvature of the two form now? Well, we use the second structure equation that we had just three slides above. So we get the variation of the expression here. And we can interchange the variation and the external derivative, like that first term like this. And so we have to vary the connection one form here, or sorry, no, but that wasn't. So we have to vary here, and then by that it will also there. Okay. So therefore, remember that the expression we really have to calculate is this one. We have to calculate that thing. The net product of h mu with the variation of omega. So the net product of h mu with the variation of omega is therefore this expression here, where let's see whether that all works out. We have the d applies to this minus the d on that. And that should give us right. So if you apply that here, we get the dh. We get dh, that variation of omega, that's just this term. So those two terms cancel each other. The exterior derivative applies to that piece, which that, minus this is just canceling each other. And so we're just left with h mu, which d of delta omega mu, that's just this term. Okay? So this is just a complicated way of writing that term. And then we are left with those two terms, that product with the h mu, these are those two terms over here. But by the definition now of the total exterior derivative, we can read off that this whole expression over here is simply the variation of omega mu back to the total exterior derivative of the h mu. Plus that term that we had here. That was the point of introducing this combination instead of that. And therefore, we have what we set out to prove, namely that the variation of star r is this expression here that led us to the Einstein equation plus a term that turns into a boundary term. Okay, we are about out of time, so let us have a break and have some sleep before we move on. The next thing will be, as I indicated at the beginning, what the point is of this business with the tetrad is you want to do the Dirac equation, you want to do global energy, global momentum, that sort of thing. Okay, that's what we will use it for now. Okay, let's have a break.